Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. By now, most of you have heard of the Keystone XL oil pipeline. But have you heard of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline? It's only 7 miles shorter than Keystone's proposed length, but it's getting a fraction of the attention. Over the past few months, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota, along with members of nearly 100 tribes from across the country, have been on the ground working to stop construction of the pipeline. It's projected to carry 470,000 to 570,000 barrels of crude oil per day from the Bakken region of northwest North Dakota to a refinery in Illinois. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has sued federal regulators for quietly approving this pipeline. The tribe argues that it poses a major threat to its drinking water supply from the Missouri River and the 8,000 tribal members who live less than a mile downstream. They also say the construction of the pipeline threatens sacred places and burial sites along the path. A federal judge is expected to rule whether the pipeline can move ahead by September 9th. So on today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about this growing movement and what's at stake. Today, we are joined by Winona LaDuke, Native American activist and executive director of Honor the Earth. Winona lives and works on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota and is a two-time vice presidential candidate with Ralph Nader on the Green Party ticket. And Winona LaDuke joins us from Minnesota. Hi, Winona. Welcome to the show.
Well, hello there.
It's great to have you back, Winona. So let's start off by talking about this pipeline, because a lot of people have not heard of this up until a couple of weeks ago. Earlier this month, Mother Jones had a piece called "The Government Quietly Just Approved This Enormous Pipeline." Can you talk about what went on behind the scenes? Why did the government decide to approve this?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that are happening. So I live in northern Minnesota. You already said that. But we have three Enbridge pipelines in our territory, and one of them is this pipeline called the Sandpiper, which was proposed from the Bakken oil fields, which is where the Dakota Access comes from, trying to get to Superior, right? And so you have a lot of landlocked oil in the Bakken that's getting out basically on train right now, and you have, you have a replumbing of North America for, quote, energy independence by taking this really, disastrously, ecologically and socially disastrous oil out of the ground, whether it's in North Dakota or Colorado or the tar sands, and trying to get it someplace, like to a refinery, because there's no refineries for where it presently is. And so you've had companies trying to figure out how to get the oil out of the Bakken. And, you know, the Keystone might have had some way to link up the tar sands oil with this other crude coming out of the Bakken, but Enbridge, largest pipeline company in North America, has been trying for 4 years to push through this pipeline called the Sandpiper in northern Minnesota, and they've gotten nowhere because we've been fighting them. The tribes have been fighting with them. Individual landowners have been fighting with them. I myself have been to like almost every hearing. So what happened about 2 weeks ago is that this other pipeline, Dakota Access, being thwarted by a company called Energy Transfer Partners out of Texas, got like 80%. It's moving along. It's like 62% done in North Dakota, 50% done in South Dakota. They were creeping along. What they did is, instead of selling it as one big Dakota Access pipeline, they partitioned it off and segmented it into a bunch of short pipelines, avoiding a whole bunch of regulation and trying to kind of sneak it through. To contextualize it, North and South Dakota, really, really bad, basically in bed with oil companies, particularly North Dakota. They control so much of the politics, the oil boom up there. And so this pipeline's been going along, and then, basically 3 weeks ago, Enbridge told all of us in Minnesota that they didn't want to date us anymore. They didn't want this Sandpiper because we've been beating them on it. And instead, they just bought the Dakota Access. And so they plan on putting a whole bunch of money into making sure that happened. And, everything kind of got heated up, went from back burner to front burner, in part with that announcement. So it got through because of a bunch of crooked politicians, the usual story, a bunch of segmenting of the regulatory process. So they were going for county and state approvals rather than larger approvals. They did not talk to the tribes, particularly Standing Rock is hugely impacted by the pipeline. They moved the pipeline so it wouldn't affect the water supply of the city of Bismarck. Instead, moved it so it would affect the water supply of the people of Standing Rock. And they kind of got it moving through. But you know, that's kind of how it's going. And, you know, I would just say that Americans are, you know, have not been noticing the replumbing of America's energy infrastructure for fracked oil and tar sands oil.
Hmm.
And that's what they're trying to do.
And what about the Obama administration? Has it made a statement on this? Where does it stand on this?
They have not made a statement on this. You know, that the tribe, you know, there's only three times a president has ever gone to an Indian reservation in history, a sitting president, and Obama went to Standing Rock last year.
Hmm.
And so it's like very ironic that he would, you know, take such a note of the condition of the people of Standing Rock, and he would go there to stand with them, and then when this comes down, would not say something. And so I think that there is a hope that Obama will intervene on behalf of the tribe. And in fact, you know, the tribe has said itself that it has never had a, it's called a consultation, it's a legal requirement. You can't, this is not 1886. This is 2016, and you have to talk to tribal governments about the impact of a proposed action on them, and that did not occur.
And I've read that the reason why Keystone got more of an environmental review is because it crossed an international border.
That is true. That is true. You know, we required that review. And then also, you know, I will make the case that, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. It's like, you know, I've been around a long time. You know, I'm 57. And I spent a lot of time fighting bad projects. But in my history, I never really fought pipelines before.
Hmm.
You know, because pipelines were things that existed. And I'm actually not opposed to pipelines. Like, I'm a first world person. I like infrastructure. I like water and pipelines. You know, and so this has not been a problem. And most of the pipelines that were put in, you know, were super old. And today they're, like, leaking and exploding. And, you know, there's just one that killed six people, I think, in New Mexico, pipeline explosion. So you got aging pipelines in this country. We got a D in infrastructure. And what they're doing now is they're trying to, because they are retooling America's energy infrastructure, basically because the United States does not want to buy oil from Venezuela, the largest oil reserves in the world, and instead wants to destroy Venezuela's economy and then go back in there and take it over, is my theory. You know, they're replumbing it so they can get oil out of places that shouldn't produce oil, like the Alberta, you know, the Athabascan River Basin shouldn't be producing oil, and nor should North Dakota. You know, they're at the bottom of the barrel fracking and destroying things. So, you know, we weren't looking at this because we didn't expect it.
Hmm. You talked about spills, and
yeah.
The New York Times had a piece about this and reports that pipeline spills and ruptures occur regularly, sometimes in small leaks and sometimes in catastrophic gushers. In 2013, a Tesoro logistics pipeline in North Dakota broke open and spilled 865,000 gallons of oil onto a farm. And then in 2010, an Enbridge energy pipeline dumped more than 843,000 gallons of oil into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan, resulting in a cleanup that lasted years and cost more than $1 billion.
No, I mean, the fact is that America's energy infrastructure has a D. And so Enbridge itself has had 800 spills. You know, there's a pipeline spill a week. Nobody pays attention to it, you know, because now what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, you don't want the bomb trains, because after all, they take out full cities like Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. And so, you know, you're going to have to do something, America. You're either going to have bomb trains or you're going to have pipelines. And what I think we should be saying is we don't want either. You know, they're not safe. And any pipeline that's in should be cleaned up. You know, we shouldn't be putting tar sands oil in it. But, you know, I don't want leaky pipelines. You know, I don't want gas mains that explode in L.A. And I don't want gas mains that explode, you know, anywhere. You know, so we need to deal with the infrastructure. And we could put a lot of Americans to work fixing America's infrastructure. And that's what they should be doing, not building pipelines for oil companies. I mean, you know, I'm sitting out here and I got piles of Enbridge pipe sitting in my backyard, literally.
Mm.
There are piles and piles of pipe for pipelines that they have been trying for 4 years to get in. And they did not get them in, and they're not going to get them in because we're fighting them. But in the meantime, I'm thinking Flint, Michigan needs those pipes.
You know, yeah.
There's a lot of places that could probably use those pipes, and they don't need to be sitting here. We don't want them. They don't want them in North Dakota.
We're speaking with Winona LaDuke, Native American activist and executive director of Honor the Earth. She lives and works on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. Today, we are talking about pipelines that go through indigenous land, including one that's now starting to get national attention. The Dakota Access Pipeline is a $3.8 billion project, and it is projected to carry 570,000 barrels of crude oil every day from the Bakken region of northwest North Dakota to a refinery in Illinois. And just to look at the maps, go to yourcallradio.org. A couple of the articles that we link to have a number of maps showing you exactly how this oil would be transported across the country. Winona, let's talk about the movement that is growing. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota got together in April. Tribal members from 100 different tribes across the country are now on the ground with them trying to stop construction. It's now starting to get national media attention. What strikes you most about what's been taking place in North Dakota?
Well, you know, this is I'm not going to say it's a remote area because I really kind of dislike that because I live in a remote area. It's like the center of the Lakota universe out there, you know? And, you know, they've been out there, they had a camp, they've been opposing it. You know, nobody was really paying attention. And then when push came down to shove, and they started, you know, I mean, you know, that this final assault, they're trying to cross, you know, right in their territory. These people stood up and everybody's kind of, you know, wanted to come support them. And so I think that people, you know, everybody knows that whether it's the Kinder Morgan or the Gateway Pipeline up in British Columbia or the Keystone Pipeline, you know, Energy East up in Canada is having problems. Nobody wants these new pipelines. I mean, you know, there's been no rain in Syria for like 5 years. Mm. Climate change is here, and what you don't need is, you know, millions of tons of CO dumped in the atmosphere, you know, just to benefit some oil companies. And people don't want them, and they don't want the spills because these pipelines spill. You know, you read the statistics yourself, but, you know, Scientific American's editor, Trudy Beller, the former editor, did a review and said, you know, looking at the data, 57% chance of a catastrophic leak of a pipeline. You know, so what's fair about that? Why should that happen? Why does that make any sense? So people are, you know, they feel like here is something, and they want to support these people. You know, to be fair, the Lakota people have really not got a fair shake by North Dakota. North Dakota is still very aggressive with them. And when the people started camping there and they blocked the road, I was like, that's a total overreach of the governor's authority. Hmm. You know, he'd like to bring the National Guard out there. He's trying to make people into, you know, something that they are not. This is a peaceful protest. You know, and I wouldn't even call it a protest. I said these are people that are defending the river.
Right, a lot of the activists have said it's not protest, we're protecting our water. Today we're speaking with Winona LaDuke. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about this pipeline and what is happening across the country with pipelines going through indigenous lands, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. This pipeline would be about 7 miles shorter than Keystone's proposed length. Only now is it starting to get national media attention. So what questions or comments do you have? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Winona, you talked about the crackdown happening in North Dakota. And Common Dreams just last week had a story about how North Dakota's Homeland Security Director Greg Wills ordered the removal of state-owned trailers and water tanks from the protest encampment despite the sweltering heat because of alleged disorderly conduct. Common Dreams got this from the Bismarck Tribune. A couple of past Your Call guests are on the ground in North Dakota. I'm hoping they're going to call in. And according to a couple of our guests on the ground, they said that the tribe had to bring in water because Homeland Security Director got rid of the water tanks.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally an aggression tactic. You know, North Dakota wants to pretend that there are bad people out there. And, you know, if you look at, you know, who is coming in, there are like grandmas, there are church people, you know, there are Black Lives Matter people, there are musicians, you know, all kinds of people are coming in there. And, you know, what they're trying to do is have some dignity here. And they removed the water, and then they put up the roadblock, and they were trying to put a squeeze on the tribe. And I was out there, and you know what happened is that, you know, they're trying to stop the casino. It's because the casino was on that road. And what happened is that a lot of people weren't equipped to camp. You know, every room at that casino is full. It's, you know, the buffet is full of people, press, media, with, you know, needed internet access because they also scrambled the internet out of the camp. I mean, I don't know if they disabled the satellite or what. You know, so the tribe is a poor tribe, you know, financially. Wealthy with land, wealthy with people, you know, very strong tribe. But they've had to, you know, bear of this, and people are coming in. You know, people are coming in, too. There's a lot of tribes coming in.
You report that two-thirds of the population of Standing Rock lives below the poverty line, which makes the construction of the pipeline even more threatening to their livelihood.
Yeah, I mean, the people are well below the poverty level, and, you know, I'm looking at what they need, and do you know what they need?
What?
You know, they need, the people out there need infrastructure themselves. you know, they need water and sewer systems. They need solar energy for their houses. They don't need a pipeline that's going to threaten and poison their water and benefit somebody else. You know, they need justice, you know? So, I mean, I'm looking at it, and it's so ironic. This community is getting international support. You know, I have not only, you know, I've done interviews, and I've fielded so many requests for people wanting to send stuff. I'm like, don't send them plastic water bottles, please. You know, get some big water tanks out there, and the people will refill their water, you know, their bottles. But, you know, we need, they're going to be out there for a while. You know, I just feel like that, but let's, you know, be supportive of these people, and I think it is totally backfiring, you know, on the state of North Dakota. Their really mean way of treating, I mean, they spend more time prosecuting people out of, you know, out of Standing Rock, litigating against the Standing Rock tribe, you know, causing health conditions and disparities. You had a woman freeze to death out there, you know, in the middle of the Bakken oil fields a couple of years ago on the Standing Rock Reservation because she couldn't pay her propane bill because the price of, you know, propane skyrocketed. You know, I'm looking at North Dakota policies that adversely affect Native people, and, you know, this pipeline is kind of the tip of the iceberg, and this happens to be the one that just tipped things where people just said, that's too much, you know, and a lot of people said, you're right.
We're speaking with Winona LaDuke, Native American activist and executive director of Honor the Earth, about the Dakota Access Pipeline, the $3.8 billion project. A number of tribes and organizations are on the ground trying to stop construction of this pipeline. And let's hear from Ben Alex Dupree, who is calling in from Standing Rock. Ben Alex has been on the show before. Hi, thanks for calling in.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. So give us an update. What are you seeing? What are people talking about?
Well, you know, today is a great day. The weather is kind of breaking, and people are going about their daily lives here at Tampa, and, you know, making fires and cooking food and visiting. And there's, you know, continues to be more tribes rolling in as the weeks go on here. There's a real air of spiritual you know, growth, and everyone's really optimistic about the relationships they're building with each other here. So there is the serious business of this pipeline just up the road. I think right now there's a really great energy going on where people feel really productive about this gathering and the excitement through Indian country that's being spread through social media. Maybe not in the national media, but Indian country is fired up over this opportunity to stand with the people and protect the water.
Well, it's starting to get national media. I don't know if you saw the video, but Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC talked about this and talked about genocide in the United States. I mean, these are words you don't usually hear in the national media.
No, I think that was a big turning point. And in fact, at one moment at the main kitchen camp, the elders had asked to turn that up, and they actually put it on the microphone for everyone to hear. And in the middle of a meal line, that was played, and he's I think one of the guys said, let's hear from the real white people, was how he put it. So, you know, there was a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek humor there about hoping that people would start to understand the significance of this movement.
And what are you hearing from young people? Because earlier this month, 500 Native youth took to the streets with their feet. They ran, actually, it wasn't 500 youth. It was a decent-sized amount, but they ran 500 miles from Cannonball, North Carolina, to the district office of the United States Army Corps of Engineers in Omaha, Nebraska. And so, Ben, are you still with us, or did we lose you?
No, I'm still here, I hope.
Okay. Winona, did we lose you?
Okay.
I think we lost.
You need help.
We lost Winona. She was on a cell phone, I think. So, Ben, tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from young people, because, I mean, it was amazing to watch these young people arrive in Omaha, and then they ran to Washington, D.C., 2,000 miles.
Right. That is a specific group of young people. They did do that, and from Cannonball, North Dakota, to it was the White House. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you're still there.
And out here, you have to understand that it's low cell signals and a lot of radio frequency interference, whether it be from the emergency vehicles or a lot of people's hand radios. It's pretty interesting out here how well your signal turns up. Sometimes you get two bars and sometimes you get none, but I don't think it's a conspiracy as much as it is just being in a rural environment. The youth are strong right now. They're very strong. They're very fired up. It's beautiful to see that they have, they've built these small schools now. They're teaching language. They're having small classes, prayer circles. The youth are constantly being either put to work to, helping around the camp, and also, sitting and learning about, songs and culture, it's really great to see this connection between all the generations, the elders and the youth, but also the middle-aged people who are kind of coming into their own as well. It's really incredible to see. It's almost like it. I don't think a day has gone by where I haven't had the hair stand up on my arms at least two or three times a day, just being moved by the imagery. Young boys as little as 3 years old helping carry wood over to the wood pile with their dads and uncles. Young women, standing around learning how to make fry bread for the first time, or even just washing dishes and just doing things to help around. I've never been in a place where everyone asks if you need anything. Like, there's, hey, how are you doing? And like, oh, good. Do you need some water? Do you need, how are your blankets? Are you warm enough? Like, people who you don't even know are extending their hand and gestures. Well, my camp's over there. If you need anything, I'll be around. So that's the energy that's going around. Where and it's not just for Native people. We had the Hawaiians meet up yesterday and said they saw one of their own, a young Hawaiian woman who was arrested on the front lines a few weeks ago. They saw that and they were moved and compelled to come here from Hawaii. And now they have a camp. And the Hawaiians are here,
wow,
and they're singing and being a part of this. And so it's very, very touching to see this movement happen. And this is my perspective outside of all the political and the government regulations and the rules and the law, all of that stuff. There's a lot of other experts here, but as an artist and a writer and a social butterfly, I'm finding these stories to be very significant in the soul and the heart and the in a much needed what would you say that? How would you even phrase it? I guess it's just the soul and the heart of the community. It's just seeing how people are keeping together when it's a cold night or a long day. The morale has to continue going, and that's very strong.
What is the plan from here on out, just to get back to, the politics around this? A federal judge is supposed to rule whether the pipeline can move ahead sometime by September 9th.
Right. I think people have committed to the long haul for the most part. People who are coming here are either planning to stay or they're bringing other family members or friends who can maintain a camp. I think the idea is we understand that this can continue. You know, continuances can happen in the court, and they probably will. And this is not going to be a quick decision, even though everyone is hoping for the best results. This movement has more to do with a spiritual awakening, the beginning of a growth, you know, for everyone.
Well, Ben Alex, thank you so much for calling in. Sure. and sharing your stories. And we'll continue to follow you online. That's Ben Alex Dupree calling in from the Standing Rock Reservation. Ben Alex is an artist and filmmaker. He was on Your Call talking about his film, The Seventh Wave. You can search for it at yourcallradio.org. I also want to thank Winona LaDuke. We just lost her on her cell phone. Native American activist and executive director of Honor the Earth. When we come back, we'll be joined by Andrea Carmen, executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can post a comment or question at KALW.org, or you can tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. They'll be talking about surrogacy in India. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about food waste. 40% of food is wasted every year in the United States. At the same time, more than 14% of U.S. households struggle to put enough food on the table. That is more than 17 million households. So what is being done to prevent food waste? Luckily, organizations are really doing some great work on this topic. That's Wednesday. Coming up on Thursday, we are going to do a show about California fires, and then we will continue our special election series Thursdays from 11 to noon. We focus on state and local issues. We're going to have a debate about Proposition 60, which would cap the price any state or healthcare program can spend on prescription drugs in California at the level paid by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, which receives very large discounts, almost the largest of any government agency. So I hope you can tune in for that. Today, we are talking about the action that's happening in North Dakota. Native Americans from tribes across the country have joined the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's growing movement to stop the construction of the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. A federal judge is going to rule whether this pipeline can move ahead by September 9th. The tribe says that the 1,100-mile pipeline threatens drinking water from the Missouri River and would disturb 300 sacred places and burial grounds. So if you have any questions or comments about this, we'd love to hear from you. It's starting now to get national media attention. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Andrea Carmen to the show. Andrea is a member of the Yaqui Nation in southern Arizona and northern Mexico and executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, which serves as an advocate for the human rights of indigenous peoples around the globe. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. You heard the end of the call from Ben Alex Dupree, who's at the Standing Rock Tribe in North Dakota, and he said that the people on the ground are in this for the long haul. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's the most important commitment that can be made because, as you know, we were asked by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe to jointly file an urgent action human rights communication to the United Nations about this situation. But I think the most important thing to support that and back that kind of action up is the solidarity and the commitment of the peoples on the ground. And that's what's going to carry the day at the end of the day. And other things, you know, whether they be court cases or whether they be filings to the United Nations like we did, based on treaty rights, environmental racism, you know, cultural rights, right to water. We covered a big spread of the different recognized human rights of indigenous peoples and nations when we filed back on, it was the 18th of August that we did this action. But the most important thing is what we were just talking about, is the commitment of the peoples on the ground, because they know the impacts are for the long run too. And I think that's really clear to the tribe and the nation and the treaty folks out there and all of the supporters, that this affects all of us, and the rights being violated are rights that are consistently being violated by corporations and the federal government. Rights of indigenous people to free, prior, informed consent before development takes place, right to self-determination, treaty rights, cultural rights, all of those recognized human rights that the U.S. has also recognized internationally don't translate into respect for those rights on the ground. And this is a example, I think, that all of us can understand based on even what's happening in our own territories around the U.S. and around the world.
Have you received any response?
As soon as we filed it through the urgent action procedures, including human rights defenders. The United Nations has a rapporteur. The rapporteur is a French word, basically, fancy French word that means human rights investigator. A lot of people are familiar with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Rights of Indigenous Peoples. When it was Jim Anaya, he did an official country visit to the U.S. in 2012. But there are many other human rights mandate holders at the U.N. And so one of the ones we did is extremely urgent, and that was under human rights defenders because of the arrests and the intimidation, you know, cutting off of basic supplies, lawsuits against the chairman. All of those things constitute violations of the rights of human rights defenders. And so we got an immediate response from the United Nations that our communication had been received, and it was going to be passed on to all of the relevant mandate holders. And we filed the first submission basically to four human rights mandate holders. The rapporteur on the situation of human rights defenders, the rights of indigenous peoples. There is also a rapporteur on the human right to safe drinking water and sanitation, and one on environment and human rights. And we also filed it to the UN Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. And we also CC'd it with the agreement of the tribe to the UN's United States State Department, including the ambassador to the Human Rights Council and the Department of Interior, the office that deals with human rights and is a liaison with the international arena. So the U.S. government was also notified at the highest level that this had been filed, and we are charging them with human rights violations in this case.
Yeah, I was curious about that, because how much weight does something like this carry?
It carries in these procedures, which is the UN rapporteurs. It carries the weight of political pressure, which is more than what you might think once you get to the UN level. We found that even the United States is very susceptible to this kind of pressure, and we've actually seen situations be resolved through these urgent action procedures. The problem is, the main problem, and I'll give maybe a couple of examples of that, but I just wanted to add that the main problem is that these kinds of communications from the UN to the countries in question that are being charged with the human rights violations are not usually made public. There can be maybe a press release issued at the end of the day, but usually these are considered private communications or maybe, I don't know if they're private, they're from, you know, United Nations to their member countries like the United States, but they're not publicized, I guess you can say. They're internally communicated, but we have seen the impact even on the United States. For instance, we just had a conference in California about protection of sacred sites a little earlier this year, and one of the attorneys working on the Medicine Lake sacred sites protection at Mount Shasta, where we've done many, many actions to the United Nations, including to the treaty bodies for protection of sacred sites. And she felt that they finally had a very good outcome. The position of the U.S. government, the Bureau of Land Management, had changed in court. And the attorney for the tribe, the Pitt River Tribe, announced publicly that she felt that a lot of the change was as a result of the pressure being put from the focus of a human rights violation in this particular case in the international arena. So our next option after this is actually to go to a legally binding procedure, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, with an urgent action. And that is a convention that the United States is actually a legal party to. And we've already began discussions with the UN CERD about accepting this case, and that would be filed in October for a November hearing. And that the advantage there is those communications are published and the results are on their website. So it adds another level of pressure on the United States to uphold their human rights commitments in this case. And it's kind of interesting because while this was going on, the day before we filed this, there was a conference call that a lot of indigenous peoples and, you know, tribes and Indian organizations in the U.S. were invited to, hosted by the U.S. State Department, to follow up on a process called the Universal Periodic Review that all countries go through at the Human Rights Council level. And one of the things that they had been recommended is to fully implement the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And one of our staff members asked them about this on the radio, about this particular situation. And they said that the United States is carrying out the implementation of the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples by doing their best to ensure that their subsidiary agencies, I guess, like the Army Corps of Engineers, are also informed that they need to implement the UN Declaration, which, of course, includes free, prior, informed consent. So there is awareness at the top level of the government about the situation and about the context and the framework of human rights that they've already agreed to internationally and how it's implicating the situation. So I'm not sure how that's going to translate into the court case. I guess we'll wait and see.
You mentioned James Anaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, who completed a 12-day visit to the United States back in 2012. He visited D.C., Arizona, Alaska, Oregon, Washington State, South Dakota, and Oklahoma. And I remember reading about this. Reuters had a piece. And he was pretty blunt. He said the United States must return control of sacred lands like the Black Hills of Dakota, which includes Mount Rushmore, to Native Americans. Has anything come of that?
Yes, absolutely. And now he's no longer in that position. The UN Rapporteur on Rights of Indigenous Peoples is named Victoria Tauli Corpus. She's an indigenous woman from the Philippines, just for information's sake. So she was the one that would receive this. We've seen some movement, but one of the big problems and one of the great things about our filing of this particular case and all the attention that it's getting, by the way, I saw last night Chairman Archambault on MSNBC on Lawrence O'Donnell's show. He was actually interviewed about this. It was really amazing, you know, the amount, the level of attention that it's getting, not just in the Indian press, in Country Today, et cetera, and they ran a story about the filing of the UN case. But part of our challenge as International Indian Treaty Council, of course, we were founded on Standing Rock back in 1974 to specifically address human rights at the United Nations and take treaty rights, which was also a big focus of our submission, is the violation of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty in this particular case, which also mandates consent. Consent, free, prior, informed consent is not a new concept at the UN. It's actually written into Article 16 of the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty and other treaties as well in the U.S. and Canada. But part of the problem is that, for us, is that the United States, whatever they may say, aren't going to be the ones that tell tribes and Indian nations when they're confronting these situations that they've actually agreed to uphold their rights in this regard and they're not doing it. So it's really an important education process that, for example, the Pitt River tribe began to go into their negotiations with the Bureau of Land Management that was, you know, promoting the destruction of the sacred site for geothermal development, Medicine Lake, and said, wait a minute here, let's restart the conversation. We know you have agreed that we have free, prior, informed consent, you know, over our sacred sites and anything that would affect our rights. So let's start again. You know, let's start this conversation over again based on a human rights framework that you've already agreed to. But they're not going to tell you that if you don't know that those rights are there. Many people, they try to say, well, the UN Declaration, it's not legally binding. It's just a declaration. Well, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, adopted in 1948, is so-called just a declaration. But no country would say they're not bound by those human rights. Not only that, a lot of the rights in the UN Declaration are already legally binding for the United States because of their treaty obligation, and even their constitution says treaties are the supreme law of the land. These treaties are ratified by the U.S. Senate. They are legally binding. The right to consent is a legally binding right, irrespective of anything that the United States has agreed to at the United Nations level, but that just supports it. There's just a new American declaration adopted this year of the Organization of American States that the United States agreed to. Which also strongly called, it actually strengthens the provisions of the UN Declaration on Treaty Rights and talks about how indigenous peoples, you know, their point of view, their understanding of the meaning of treaties needs to be the definition that prevails, you know, legally. So the United States agreed to that. They signed on to the outcome document of the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples in 2014, reiterating the right to free, prior, informed consent. But did they tell tribes that? No. So this is why this is so important, and the publicity that this submission to the UN has gotten is it's really, I think, invigorated a lot of tribal nations and treaty nations' understanding of how powerful the UN human rights framework is as a tool in terms of recognizing treaty rights and right to free, prior, informed consent, protection of sacred sites, and we just have to use it. So let's see what happens with this particular response, and we're prepared, and the tribe has asked us to continue to address this issue at the international level.
Andrea Carmen is a member of the Yaqui Nation in southern Arizona and north Mexico. She's executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council, and they have issued an urgent call to UN Human Rights Special Rapporteurs, citing ongoing threats and violations to the human rights of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North Dakota. Over the past couple of months, the tribe, along with members of nearly 100 tribes across the country, are on the ground working to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. It's a $3.8 billion project projected to carry 570,000 barrels of crude oil every day from the Bakken region of northwest North Dakota to a refinery in Illinois. The tribe says it poses a major threat to the water supply coming from the Missouri River And they also say the construction of the pipeline threatens sacred places and burial sites. And so today we are talking about efforts to stop this pipeline. We have a couple emails. Janelle says, as an elder white woman, I want to thank your call and those who are representing the protections of waters in North Dakota. I am thrilled that Native Americans are speaking up and finally being heard. We need their wisdom and the courage of our youth as they face the grasping decadence of an empire in demise. One day we may understand that our perception of separation is an illusion. Thank you for your part in that. Thanks for the email, Janelle. Mark in San Francisco says, oil pipelines exist to feed our addiction to gasoline and diesel for our cars. Today, that's a choice, not a necessity. There are dozens of plug-in electric cars available that replace oil with cleaner, cheaper electricity. Support the Native people's effort to protect their land by switching to a plug-in car. Thank you for that, Mark. And Jennifer says, thank you to all of the Native Americans who stand up, not just for yourselves, but for all of us. The Bad River Tribe saved us from a taconite mine in Wisconsin. Not sure I'm saying that right, but thank you for writing in, Jenny. And you can give us send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We have just a couple of minutes left. And I wanted to also ask you, Andrea, about the lawsuit that was filed by Earth Justice. They're representing the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. They filed this back in July, last month, in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Standing Rock says the project violates federal and treaty laws, and a judge is expected to rule whether the pipeline can move ahead. We're expecting a decision by September 9th. What are your thoughts on this lawsuit?
I think that it has very strong legal grounds, and of course we support all of the efforts, and it's great that organizations like Earth Justice are also coming in, you know, to support the nation in this particular case. And certainly it's very important that we keep a very firm position on the rights of Indian nations under treaty, you know, over 300 ratified treaties, which are legally binding. And our position at the United Nations was based on, from the beginning, you know, now 40 years ago, on that treaty relationship that is an international relationship. And our position is the United States has signed on to other conventions and treaties of the United Nations, but the treaties they signed with the Indian nations are the ones that have been violated with impunity. And these are now recognized as also international relationships, international agreements, and they need to be kept alive. And we must continue to insist that the United States uphold their obligations. And again, they have agreed to do that by becoming party to international standards. Most recently, the Organization of American States, American Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that reiterate this legally binding commitment. And so we'd like to see when that's going to be implemented on the ground. And the only way that we can do this is to continue to hold their feet to the fire in this way. So we totally support the lawsuit, and we'll be following it closely. We've informed the United Nations that there is this legal procedure going on, and if there is a positive outcome, you know, we will certainly inform them. And we trust from our experience that any communication and pressure that the United States is receiving from the United Nations human rights system will have a positive impact on this lawsuit and other efforts.
Back in November, President Obama announced his decision to reject the Keystone XL pipeline after 7 years of intense debates and so many protests across the country. Again, this particular pipeline is about 7 miles shorter than Keystone, but it's only now getting national attention. What could the Obama administration do in this case?
Well, I was there, as were other Indigenous peoples, at the 21st Conference of the Parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in Paris. I'm one of the two coordinators of the Global Steering Committee for that effort from North America. And I actually saw the speech in person by President Obama and there at COP21 in Paris. And he actually said that we are the first generation to be impacted by climate change and the last generation to be able to do anything about it. And this is what doesn't make sense to me, you know, that they're coming back here and promoting, you know, coal mining and oil development in Alaska and oil pipelines and basically carrying out business as usual, when actually the United States was one of the first countries to sign the Paris Agreement to reduce dramatically global warming. And also we fought and were able to achieve recognition for the rights of indigenous peoples in the Paris Agreement, the legally binding climate change agreement. So that's just one more example of how pressure maybe could be put on President Obama, who supposedly is, you know, a real advocate of alternative energy and reducing the global impacts of greenhouse gas emissions from the United States, which is the highest per capita still in the world. I'm hoping that those that have his ear will remind him of the commitments that some of us have actually seen him make personally to reduce the United States' dependency on fossil fuels, which affects each and every one of us as well as each and every living thing on the earth.
And Andrea, what's next? We have about a minute left.
Continuing resistance, the work on the lawsuits. We will continue to keep the United Nations informed of ongoing human rights violations till the situation becomes resolved to the satisfaction of the nation, where their rights are being respected and their future generations are safeguarded. We will continue to be part of this struggle. Again, we feel a strong commitment. You know, the Lakota Nation is part of the International Indian Treaty Council, and we were actually born on the Standing Rock Reservation. So our commitment is 100% to continue to support the tribe in this matter and the resistors there on the ground, and in any way that we can continue to utilize our expertise in the international arena that was born out of the first meeting there in Standing Rock. Our commitment is 100% to the struggle.
Well, again, we are expecting a decision by a judge who's going to rule on whether the pipeline can move ahead by September 9th, and we will definitely follow that. Andrea Carmen is a member of the Yaqui Nation in southern Arizona and north Mexico and executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. Andrea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to those out on the ground in Standing Rock. You're there for all of us. For my grandchildren, too.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the 40% of food that's wasted every year in the U.S., a cult of perfection, misleading expiration dates, and donating concerns all contribute to food ending up in the trash. Meanwhile, more than 14% of U.S. households struggle to put enough food on the table. So what's being done to prevent food waste? Tweet your questions and comments to @YourCallRadio and join the next Your Call live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.